Hello, lovely digital listeners. Introducing Schools to Prisons, a collaborative research project between Our American Generation and the League of Education Voters. This project is about highlighting the concerning link between our nation's prisons and public education systems, a link that turns struggling students into juvenile delinquents.
Between us, we have two nonprofits. One, a youth-driven social justice think tank. The other, a statewide advocacy organization aimed at fixing Washington's public schools. Together, these groups are exploring the role of race and wealth in our public school system and how different demographics usually end up with different outcomes. Did you know that black male students are 3 times as likely to be suspended than white male students? Why do Latino students consistently perform worse on standardized tests when we know they are just as smart? These are some of the questions this series hopes to answer.
So we began this project in hopes of building off of OAG's Crime and Community zine. We started simply by looking at the data we already knew existed. There's research out there on what many refer to as the achievement gap. In a nutshell, since No Child Left Behind was passed in 2002, schools nationwide have been required to release their test scores and graduation rates broken down by race and economic status. Now that this data is required, we have a very powerful tool for measuring public school success rates by race and by income. So when folks in the U.S. started to observe all this new data, a disturbing trend was revealed, one that many already knew from experience. Our country's public school system is serving students of color and low-income students worse than white or higher-income students.
It's important to note that many studying this topic refer to it as the achievement gap. But for the purpose of our research here, we're referring to it as an opportunity gap for several reasons. Mainly, we aim to move away from a discussion that is focused on an individual student's achievement on a test or a grade, and more towards a discussion that looks at how our schools systematically deny students opportunities for success. This redefinition also helps remind us that there are large social implications for disparities in educational attainment. It's not just a matter of missed income for an individual that doesn't graduate from high school. It's the general welfare and prosperity of our entire nation that suffers.
In this podcast, we'll be taking a closer look at the actual cost of our nation's inequities within the public school system. When we talk about cost here, we're talking about more than a dollar amount. There are definitely lost opportunities for an individual when he or she doesn't graduate high school, but we'll also try to shed light on some of the social and cultural costs to school climate under zero tolerance policies. And we'll look at some of the drawbacks for Washington State when we don't educate our students.
We'll share some information that might illuminate how the opportunity gap not only affects the students who are denied access to a quality education, but also society as a whole. We'll also dive into some financial comparisons between our state budget for education and our state budget for correctional services. As you listen, think about how the story we are telling relates to your own experiences in schools, whether public or private. Finally, think about how you'd make our education system better. Where would you invest the public funds, and what policies would you change?
It might be easiest to start by talking about what is lost when a young person doesn't get a high school diploma. What can we predict about this person's life? To start off with a really big picture example, one report told us that high school graduates live up to 7 years longer than students who drop out. This is an example of a pretty extreme cost, and not one that we would usually think to associate with a lack of education. Yet, it's kind of a huge deal.
Here's something to be hopeful about. According to the National Center of Education Research, nationally dropout rates as a whole have declined over the last 40 years. That's the good news. However, when we look at graduation rates broken down by income level, there are still some pretty big inequities. Low-income students drop out 4 times more often than their higher income earning peers. And we don't want to get all dare on listeners, but this is an extremely alarming and tangible loss.
Another study we found from the Washington State Institute for Public Policy released some information that tells us graduating from high school can reduce the chance of criminal activity by up to 10%. A study conducted in 2007 shows that 1 in 10 young male dropouts are in jail, compared to only 1 in 33 high school graduates. If we know and understand the value of a diploma for a young person, Why does it seem like our school discipline policies are designed to keep students out? We read story after story talking about the hurdles families must overcome sometimes to keep young folks in school.
What message are we sending young people about our investment in their success? We'll unpack some of these policies a bit later and show how some schools' approaches to discipline actually push students into the criminal justice system and out of the classroom.
Before we do that, here's more info about what's lost when a young person leaves high school. The Washington State Institute for Public Policy released a study that shows high school graduates will earn 24% more money in their lifetime than students who drop out. We're theoretically talking about moving up an entire income bracket here, all because of a diploma. Money doesn't have to be your mode of operation, but it is absolutely a vehicle to steady access to healthcare. When we were talking about how graduates live longer than dropouts, that study listed indicators such as increased income and better health as measures that contributed to a person's longer lifespan. Consider how all these disadvantages might add up as well.
We're spinning ourselves into a confusing web where young students of color and young students from lower economic backgrounds are dropping out at higher rates and are also disproportionately affected by discipline policies that create huge hurdles for graduation.
Some students might drop out for other reasons. Maybe they have health issues which are hard to manage with school schedules. Perhaps they need to work full-time to help support their families. Or maybe they just don't feel safe on campus. There are also some less obvious explanations. We interviewed Professor Wayne Au of UW-Bothell to ask his perspective on a few things, as a former teacher in the Seattle public school system and current editor of an online journal called Rethinking Schools.
I think a lot of like middle-class and upper-middle-class kids see the value in school because they feel like they see a payoff at the end, right? Like their parents are professionals or whatever. But like, you know, if you don't see the payoff in school at the end, if you don't know that you're going to be able to go to college, you don't see yourself being able to be successful in whatever, then why would you care?
We know that students drop out of high school for all kinds of reasons. But we also know that there are specific policies and environments that facilitate this process. In recapping, regardless of why students are leaving the schoolhouse, some of the direct results are loss of personal income, increased chance of criminal interaction with the police, and that big one, a shorter lifespan of 7 years. As we discussed in the first podcast, our broken education system is more than just a problem for individuals trying to navigate their way through. There's also lots of data that shows what we as a nation can stand to lose from not educating our young people. These are messages we're all pretty familiar with, actually. The importance of educating our young people has held true throughout the last three presidencies. In Clinton's 1994 State of the Union address, he declared the standard by which all performance would be measured. Are your children learning what they need to know to compete and win in the global economy?
Bush's presidency marked the introduction of the No Child Left Behind era. Fast forward to Obama's 2011 address, where the theme, Winning the Future, illuminated his belief that investing in education will allow us to win back our economic position in the global market.
This feels like good news to some degree, because our nation has identified that we have an education problem that needs to be fixed. However, it also feels like we're not addressing the elephant in the room, that our schools and prison systems treat students of color and low-income students worse than wealthy white kids. We're also troubled by all the rhetoric surrounding the global economy and preparing young minds for the workforce. We're losing some very human elements to education if our discussion is only focused on competing for a piece of the global market pie.
For many of us, making money and winning the global economy is not the number one reason to provide young people with a good education. I've never heard a teacher describe their calling to teach like that, anyway. Schools are where we learn identity. They are where we develop passions, try new things by participating in extracurricular activities, forge friendships, and build a foundation for our future. Education is how we begin to develop the values that will shape our decisions throughout life. But if our decision makers see schools solely as human capital factories, at one point do our students begin to lose their sense of self? Could the perspective of students as up-and-coming workers be related to our tendency towards discipline?
Schools need to find a balance between teaching young people the skills they need to find success in the workplace and the skills that teach young people to love learning. A rich learning environment is one that allows opportunity for individuals to develop their interests and pursuits outside of merely their careers. Therefore, our education institutions should be best suited to provide young people with opportunities to realize their full human capacity. Sadly, It is precisely here that we're failing them. We're not talking about a conspiracy here either. Some educators we spoke to were pretty explicit in their beliefs that their main objective was to prepare their high school students for a minimum wage job. That was their idea of success.
If the mighty dollar is the bottom line, any threats to that bottom line will be taken seriously. While education should absolutely prepare you for a career, we think educators and administrators are selling students short if that's their only goal. It's especially true when we come to issues of discipline. Schools across the nation mostly rely on zero-tolerance policies that give teachers little to no wiggle room and are quick to earn students suspension or expulsion for crimes that don't fit the punishment. As we discussed in the first podcast, this notion of zero-tolerance policy was once used as a means to crack down on serious threats to student safety at school, but have since spread to encompass drugs, truancy, gangs, disrespect, and property damage. Zero-tolerance policies are, in other words, no second-chance policies. They can intensify truancy and also establish a pattern of suspension where, as punishment, the student misses so much class that catching back up on schoolwork is impossible. Dropping out becomes inevitable after months of sporadic attendance. We've already discussed data that suggests dropouts are more prone to criminal behavior, so we're seeing a literal push of students into the criminal court system in a misguided attempt to create safety.
Zero-tolerance policies go wrong by mandating disciplinary actions that punish instead of analyze and improve a student's behavior. Although zero-tolerance policies vary from school district to school district, mostly they mandate only three punishments: suspension, expulsion, and in-school arrest. A terrific case study of zero-tolerance policy was taken in 2004 in the Baltimore School District. The research found that the intensity and frequency of punishments was increasing, and the justification for this increase was nowhere to be found. During 4 out of the first 5 years of zero-tolerance policies in Baltimore, suspension rates were on the rise, not to mention that Baltimore already posted the highest suspension rate in the state of Maryland. Here's the worst part. Nearly 15% of these suspensions were for tardiness, while a mere 2.5% were for the weapons violations that spurred zero-tolerance policies in the first place. Furthermore, the connection between our schools and prisons were tightened. In just a single year, in-school arrests increased by over 30%.
Another starting point for many juvenile detention cases is the use or possession of illegal substances, and many school disciplinary issues arise from possession on school property. Washington's statewide policy is that schools are a drug and weapon-free zone, so school administrators have restricted options in their punishment of students for these cases. Usually nothing less than suspension is accepted. The issue is not whether young people will use drugs, because some will, but we can change how we educate and monitor young people using drugs on school property. We could adopt a more holistic approach to supporting healthy kids within our educational institutions. Instead of severely disciplining a student caught using on school grounds, schools can focus on educating toward recovery or responsible use. Schools could alter how they handle discipline so that policies don't penalize students after they've gotten in trouble. Instead, they could reallocate funding to be spent on punishments toward health and recovery services. Students will also be disciplined for fighting or perceived gang involvement, which are ultimately issues of safety for young people. Fighting and harassment, both between students and toward faculty and staff, are a real challenge in some classrooms and schools. Sadly, this is another example of where discipline does more to hide the problem than to resolve it. Cuts to school budgets do not help ease the challenge teachers and principals face in creating safe learning spaces. Newer, younger, more energized teachers who can relate best to students are the first to be let go when layoffs happen. Less teachers means more students in each classroom with less personal attention. When school budget crunches happen, other personnel positions are cut too, like counseling services and adult mentor programs, college advisors, and community support staff. Textbooks become outdated, facilities deteriorate, sports and arts programs are slashed, and students are left feeling like no one cares and no one is there to help.
Since the 1980s, Washington's spending on kindergarten through 12th grade has decreased significantly. We now rank as one of the lowest amongst all 50 states. In terms of how much money the state spends on students in college, the divestment over the last 30 years is even more striking. In 1980, state funding accounted for about 3/4 of the cost of educating a Washington student. In 2011, that figure has dropped to less than half. Recently, a school superintendent in Michigan wrote a letter to the governor there asking that the schools in his district be converted to prison. He writes,
"Consider the life of a Michigan prisoner. They get 3 square meals a day, access to free health care, internet, cable television, access to a library, a weight room, computer lab. They can even earn a degree, a roof over their heads, clothing. Everything we just listed, we do not provide to our school children."
This letter is obviously tongue-in-cheek, but it raises some important issues. If the quality of prison life, in terms of health services, diet, and access to technology, is better than our public school system, then this is a real problem. It means in some cases, there is actually an incentive, in worst case scenario, a dependency on incarceration to provide social services to young folks.
Since 1995, Washington State's per-pupil spending has been lagging more and more behind the national average. We spend roughly $10,000 on a student's public education each year. However, Washington shells out nearly $25,000 per year for prison inmates. This means that as a state, we spend 2.5 times more money on prisoners than on our young people's education. One reason, but certainly not an excuse, for this difference in education and correctional spending has to do with our state tax system and our funding structure for public schools in general. This was a hot topic of discussion this past legislative session. We're in a recession. This is not news. In actuality, what this literally means is that Washington State owes more money to schools, prisons, social services, and state employees than it makes each year from taxing citizens. It owes $4.6 billion, to be exact, and people are projecting an even greater budget deficit in the coming years. What exactly happened to get us to this point? In the fall of 2010, a slew of anti-tax votes happened. State Initiative 1107 passed with flying colors, an initiative to repeal the soda tax, a small tax on items like bottled water, candy, and of course, soda. A UW student told us he saw a Coca-Cola bottling truck on campus with huge letters urging voters to vote yes on 1107. In fact, almost $20 million was spent on the campaign to pass 1107, making it the most expensive campaign in our state's history. And it worked. It worked because no one on the other side told the voters where the 2 to 3 cents per item tax was going, toward education and healthcare. Look at our priorities. $20 million spent on a campaign to stop more funding for public schools.
In addition to 1107, a lovely initiative from Tim Iman required that the House and the Senate would need a two-thirds majority vote to pass any new form of revenue for Washington. New revenue is, in fact, a euphemism for new taxes. Because of the nature of our House and Senate, which are both fairly evenly split between Republicans and Democrats, it's nearly impossible to pass a new tax with a two-thirds approval. Voters also voted down an initiative that would reform Washington's income tax structure. Currently, low-income earners pay over 6.5% more income tax than high-income earners through regressive sales tax. This was yet another missed opportunity to reform the ways Washington gets revenue for social services. This was yet another missed opportunity to reform the ways Washington gets revenue for social services. So 10 months later, here we are, facing huge, enormous budget cuts because of a couple measures that have handcuffed our elected officials from stirring up more funding. But we shouldn't let legislators off the hook entirely either. This past session, they had an opportunity to close tax loopholes on a few large banking corporations in Washington, and they chose not to.
Simple faith in human nature leads me to hope that if people actually knew where those tax dollars were going, we would have voted differently. Over 3 years, the soda tax was expected to generate $300 million in revenue for our state. But through a campaign of misinformation, corporate lobbyists won, and our education system is left suffering. When we're talking about the societal cost of educating our young people, it's twofold. It will literally take us restructuring our tax and funding systems through policy changes to create new and stable sources of revenue for our schools. This is the tough work that lies ahead of us. If we revisit the human capital perspective for a moment, we'll see that even though our commanders-in-chief have demanded higher standards from our schools in order to boost the economy, the investment has not exactly come in full force. Funding may not be a silver bullet for education problems, but it's a necessary ingredient for schools to get better.
A recent survey from Georgetown University showed us that by 2018, just 7 years from now, Washington will be one of the states with the highest demand for post-secondary education. The study shows that 68% of Washington's job opportunities will require at least 2 years of college. Unfortunately, in Washington, only around 75% of our students are even graduating from high school on time. 35% who graduate are going on to college of some sort, yet only 18% are finishing a degree within 6 years of starting college.
Obama and Clinton aren't that far off in their assertion that education will make us financially successful. The opportunity gap is proven to directly affect our economic ranking. The United States trails behind global education leaders like Finland and Korea when it comes to achievement levels. If we had been able to close that gap, like we were supposed to with the introduction of No Child Left Behind, our gross domestic product could have risen up to 16% by 2008. Additionally, Northwestern University's Center for Labor Market Studies released a report in 2009 that said high school dropouts cost more to our economy than they will contribute over their lifetime. They estimated the figure was about $250,000. The way this study measured the contribution was through a comparison of how much a citizen gave through things like property and income tax versus how much they took via social services. It shed light on how costly parole, probation, incarceration, and court services really are.
Through national surveys and a targeted study of GED recipients, they were left with the glaring reality that our zero-tolerance policies and focus on human capital is actually having the opposite effect of those students being targeted. We're spending more on them than they are able to contribute. This reveals how costly it is to rely heavily on the juvenile justice system as a crutch to the education system, and this is exactly what we're doing. Disciplinary methods prolong a student's education and hurt their individual self-confidence. Our current discipline approach intensifies delinquency.
The alternative to discipline and pushing kids out of school is investment and a commitment to the education system. One such investment is the creation of standard early education programs within school districts. In Washington, we have a state-funded preschool program for low-income families called Head Start. However, the income level required to qualify is super low, and because of Washington's tax structure, there are already many folks who actually do qualify for Head Start, but can't find a classroom with any openings. On the flip side, preschool is often for the middle to upper class who can afford to pay for private education. So we're literally seeing how class and family income can determine from a very early age what a child's academic opportunities are going to look like. Experts say that by investing in high-quality early learning, we can earn a return of anywhere from $3 to $17 for every $1 spent. Early childhood education can prevent the need for special education programs as children grow older and have been shown to decrease teen pregnancy rates and welfare services. It also reduces need for more expensive later intervention programs like GED courses. Lastly, and this should make Clinton, Bush, and Obama happy, an American Public Human Services Association report tells us that children who participate in high-quality early learning programs are more likely to graduate, go on to college, and consequently earn more during their lifetime. And that actually makes me pretty happy, too.
Me too. Not only is discipline proven to be costly and destructive to our nation's youth, it is also a wasted cost to taxpayers at large. The researchers behind this podcast are wholeheartedly calling for more investment in education. But we must recognize that the United States is incredibly tax-averse and still facing a recession. In light of this, divestment in other areas of government may be necessary to shore up education investments. We would point to our rapidly expanding private prison systems, which are funded entirely by government contracts. Juvenile justice programs are proven to be more expensive and less enriching than public education programs, particularly preschool. The Michigan school superintendent was right to tease about how simple the solution looks. Fund our schools at least as much as we fund our prisons.
Going back to the example of the Baltimore School District, we can find some hope in progress. Fast forward 6 years to 2010, and Baltimore has abandoned zero tolerance policies and suspensions entirely in reaction to the fallout they brought. Officials increased monitoring and data collection of at-risk children and offered support services for families. The Maryland Secretary of Juvenile Services said, "We were looking at files and realized that there were many missed opportunities to intervene in their lives. If you have a kid that's kind of gone off track and you continue to let that situation go unattended, you're going to have a serious problem later on." Over the course of 5 years, the school district managed to reduce annual suspensions from 26,000 to under 10,000, a drop of over 60%. These achievements grew from newfound investment in early learning and crime prevention programs and a movement away from discipline and zero tolerance policies. This goes to prove that nothing is more effective than staying committed to our youth. And we'll leave you on that positive note for this week. We hope you enjoyed this look at the cost of inequity in our public education system. Next week, we'll turn to the implications of this inequality in terms of race and social relations within the United States. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.